prize. His absence, and that of Maxine, left a dark hole in her life, though she hated herself for thinking so. She grabbed the stack of mail and thanked Mr. Bard once more. Her preference would have been to fall into a tub of hot water and soak, letting the muscles tensed from days on the road work out their kinks. But 2 weeks wasn't much time, and she had to make the most of it. She changed into clean clothes and refreshed her face with some cool water before heading uptown. Her mother hugged her and brought her inside the apartment, where the smell of a pot roast made Hazel's stomach growl. For all of Ruth's faults, she was an excellent cook. Ruth embraced Hazel and took her coat. "Come in, see your father, and we'll eat right off." Hazel handed over the bag of groceries she'd picked up at the store on Broadway. While she was earning money, she wanted to share the largesse. Or perhaps it was a proud gesture to prove that she was still a successful artist and that nothing had changed, even though everything had changed. "You are a dear." Ruth kissed her on the cheek and laughed, a light, tinkling sound better suited to an ingenue. Hazel and Ben had been certain she'd cultivated the giggle as a schoolgirl and refused to part with it, despite her advancing years. Both her parents had aged greatly since Hazel's fall from grace. Their theatrical friends had mostly abandoned them after the news of Hazel's affair with Charlie broke, and they were left outcasts. Her father had faded into himself more and more, no longer making any grunts of approval or even raising his eyebrows, while her mother had become a constant source of noise, either humming or talking back to the radio as if to make up for the silence. How far they'd come. When Hazel was a struggling understudy, Ruth had been angry at what she perceived to be her lack of ambition and refusal to take direction. When Hazel made it into the big time, Ruth resented her independence. Yet these days, her mother was nothing but supportive and kind, and no longer controlling. She'd stood by Hazel, unlike most of the others, and only wanted her daughter to be happy. Hazel's trajectory had allowed her mother to finally work through her sticky grudges and come out the other side a softer woman. "You don't have to go back to that hotel, Hazel." Ruth placed a large slice of beef on Hazel's plate before turning to her husband and cutting his food with a practiced efficiency. "You could move back into your old room." "I'm fine there, thank you, though. Why pay all that rent money when you're on the road most of the time anyway? Mr. Bard's been very understanding." "He'll get tired of it before long, trust me. I really don't understand it." Hazel knew there was no point in explaining. True, economically it made sense to move back home, but there was no place like the hotel, her oasis of crazy calm. She loved hearing Mr. Kleinzinger's piano compositions as they drifted down and around the serpentine stairway from his room on the 10th floor, like a melodious ghost. Sure, his pet boa constrictor occasionally turned up in the hallway, but no one really seemed to mind. Artsy and crazy were one and the same here, no questions asked. It was the only place she could write as well, the only place she wanted to write, not that she'd had much luck lately. The two scripts she'd tried to submit under a different name had been rejected. No doubt the radio producers had asked around and figured out her true identity. All the blacklisted writers were trying the same scam. Back at the hotel later that evening, determined not to waste a minute, Hazel sat at her desk by the window and rolled a sheet of paper into her typewriter. Really, she should go to bed and start fresh in the morning, but waking up to a blank piece of paper tomorrow would be the end of her. Better to get something down now, even if it was just a page, something she could shape and edit, than to have nothing at all. What, though? A new play? A novel? She could write about her terrible experiences of the past year, but it was too close. No one cared, anyway. Her voice had been stifled, and that particular fire within her extinguished. For a split second, she thought of stepping down the hallway and talking it through with Maxine, before remembering that Maxine was gone and had betrayed her. On the tour bus back to New York, Hazel had opened a magazine that one of the actresses had left lying on the seat to a full-page spread of Maxine and her leading man somewhere in Europe posing for photos, Maxine's mouth wide and smiling. But Hazel knew that smile. That smile meant she had something to prove. That smile was her defense when she felt small. Hazel ripped the sheet of paper out of the typewriter, rolled it into a tight ball, and pitched it across the room, before instantly regretting wasting a perfectly good piece of paper. The stack of mail sat on the very edge of the desk. A diversion. Only one was an anonymous letter of fury, which she dumped right into the trash. A couple were from playwrights she knew in passing, offering their support. That was an unexpected surprise. Maybe eventually the tide would turn and she'd no longer be a pariah. The one that had been sent special delivery had no return address. She sliced it open, wary, as if a goblin might jump out. But when she saw the scrawl at the bottom, she gasped. Charlie. He apologized for not reaching out sooner, but wrote that it was safer for him to remain at a distance. He'd sent the letter to Mr. Bard inside a larger envelope with instructions for him to pass it directly to Hazel. The note was terse, lacking any warmth. He said he'd be in town over Christmas and asked if they could meet December 26th at noon at the New York Public Library on Fifth Avenue. He'd be waiting by the information desk in the reading room. She imagined walking into the reading room, sun pouring in through the arched windows and finding Charlie standing there. Maybe he'd smile and reach out his arms to her. God, how she missed him. She shook off the image. Charlie had abandoned her right when she needed him most. He was probably upstate, doing his father's bidding, or had joined the FBI after all and wanted to continue on with his spy hunt. She put his letter to the side and opened the last one in the stack. It was from Floyd, dated 2 days ago. He said he was in a terrible state and needed to see her, that he was staying at the Taft Hotel in Midtown. The hotel operator put her through, but there was no answer in Floyd's room. Hazel left a message saying she was on her way and rushed out into the night. The Taft Hotel rose out of the sidewalks of 7th Avenue like a prison, brown and imposing. Hazel went straight up to the room number Floyd had given her and knocked on the door. No answer. Finally, after what seemed like ages, she heard footsteps on the other side of the door. "Hazel, my darling!" Floyd welcomed her inside as if he were throwing a garden party, all smiles and cheek kisses. He looked paler than she remembered, but maybe it was just from the dimness. Only one lamp over by the window was lit, the bulb too weak to reach the corners of the small room. Floyd gestured for Hazel to take a seat in the lone chair as he poured her a drink from the bar. "Is the open window all right? I can close it if you like." The cool breeze offset the smoky, stagnant air inside. She didn't remember ever seeing Floyd with a cigarette before, but the overflowing ashtray on the nightstand pointed to a serious habit. "No, it's perfectly fine. Refreshing." She took a sip of her drink, pure vodka. "I'm sorry I didn't get here sooner." "No matter. You're here now." How he'd changed from that sweet boy in Naples, sketching caricatures of the men, handing the paper over with a shy smile that spread to a blush as the soldier burst into pleased laughter. Hazel wondered how he'd draw himself now. His ears still stuck out like a schoolboy's, but his forehead was lined, his eyes puffy and red. He'd filled out since the war, his shoulders and arms thickening with muscles, but now seemed to be reversing course. His limbs, and even his fingers, longer and thinner than she remembered. "What's happened? We've been so worried about you." He perched on the bed with his drink. "I didn't name names, just so we're clear about that." Rumors had flown since Floyd had disappeared, that he'd turned on his friends, that he wasn't who he appeared to be. Hazel had swatted down every one and defended him, and would continue to do so until she knew the truth. It was such a relief to see him after all this time. "I know you and Charlie were close." He took a big sip of his drink, spilling a little and wiping it with his sleeve like a kid. "I don't blame you one bit for what came out in the papers. He is a delightful man, not like his father." A flash of heat went through her. "We're not together anymore." "I'm sorry to hear that." They sat silently for a minute before Floyd let out a sharp laugh. Did you know they apparently have box scores for us now? They're released every month and passed around to all the ad agencies. What do you mean? It's a guide to who's in and who's out. For example, it'll say, Jose Ferrer, avoid his latest movie. I was told that mine said, Floyd Jenkins, done for good. So many decent people, like Floyd, were being bulldozed. I know it seems awful now, but you must hang in there. You're so talented and a delight to work with. You'll have a bang-up career again, I'm sure. They're still bringing me in for interviews, said Floyd. She brightened. This was a good sign that the producers were still seeing him. Maybe all was not lost. That's great. Who? No, not anyone in show business. The FBI. The fight drained out of her. I keep telling them it was a silly comment in front of friends. Oh, right, all of us are commies. It was sarcasm, I tell them, but they don't care. It was obvious Floyd replayed the conversation in his mind over and over, reliving the moment when he'd unknowingly sealed his fate. All because of an orange dress. Sorry, tangerine. Like Maxine, Brandy was working nonstop these days. Hazel was still unsure of why he'd called her here. Maybe I can help with your situation. Do you have a lawyer? She opened her purse, searched for a business card, and laid it on the side table. Mr. Stone was quite helpful to me. Here's his number. He offered up a half-smile. Right. Thank you for that. I'll ring him. Floyd had no money to afford a lawyer like Stone, Hazel realized. She offered to loan him some, but he wouldn't accept it. Another uncomfortable silence. Floyd's gift as an artist was his sensitivity, but that same gift made the real world much harder for him than it was for Hazel. The terrible sanctions against him had wrecked him. "Don't lose hope," she said. "You can do other things. You're a brilliant artist. Let's see what else we can find you. A job in an art gallery, perhaps. Or wait, what about teaching?" "No one will hire me after next week. They've made that much clear."
"Next week?
Who've made it clear? What do you mean?"
"I'm not who you think I am.
The deadline has finally arrived, and since I refused to cooperate, they're going to tell the world who I am." By now she was utterly confused. "Who are you?" "They called me back, week after week, hoping I'd cave in. I suppose they've finally realized who they're up against, that I won't turn on my friends." He let out an anguished sob. "You see, they know that I love men. They have photos. Proof." He waved one hand in the air, and with that, the curtain falls. A chill ran through Hazel. That would be the end of Floyd's career, no matter what he chose to do. While Hazel couldn't care less who Floyd loved, as long as he was happy, no one in the industry would hire someone who'd been exposed as a homosexual. He'd be shunned, even worse than Hazel was. That the FBI would stoop to this level infuriated Hazel. "That's not acceptable," she said. "We will not be railroaded. I've got your back, Floyd, and don't you forget it." Floyd wavered a tiny bit from side to side. Hazel glanced at the vodka bottle, which was two-thirds empty. Tonight was probably not the best time to figure out his plan B. "Look, you get a good night's sleep, and I'll come by tomorrow and take you out for breakfast. In the light of day, it won't seem so bad. We'll find you a decent job, I promise." His eyelids drooped and stayed closed. She rose and gently extricated the glass from his hand, placing it on the bar next to hers. "For now, lie down and get some rest." "Thanks, Hazel." He was awake again, his blue eyes shining. "Thank you for coming to the rescue. I'm sorry I've been away for so long. I know how lonely it can be when you feel like you've been abandoned."
"We've all been abandoned.
I hear Maxine's star is ascending rapidly, just as ours is falling." He began to cry.
"They say she talked. She told them whatever they wanted to hear. How could she have done that?"
She didn't want to discuss Maxine. "We have each other." Hazel leaned over Floyd and gave him an awkward hug. "Enough being maudlin. One day I'll write a zany comedy about this year, and you'll do the costumes, and everyone will love us once again."
"We'll do that, Hazel."
When she left, she closed the room door behind her quietly, in case Floyd had already fallen asleep. Not for the first time, she wished she had Maxine, the old Maxine, by her side. She would have cajoled Floyd out of his funk, got him back on his feet. With her film earnings, she also would have been able to help out financially. But neither Hazel nor Floyd would ever touch a penny, knowing that her riches came right out of their own pockets. She got to work precisely because she'd thrown them and others like them to the wolves. The elevator opened, but Hazel hesitated. The elderly couple inside glared at her. "Sorry, I forgot something," she called out as the doors slid shut. She hurried back down the hall. It didn't feel right, leaving Floyd so fast. He shouldn't be alone. She pushed open the door quietly and saw the curtains flapping in the breeze. She walked in, intending to close the window so he wouldn't wake up in the morning with a cold, but stopped short. The bed was empty, the door to the bathroom shut. She stood next to the door, listening for sounds of water running, of movement. Nothing. "Floyd?" She knocked gently. "I came back. I wanted to make sure you're really all right." Nothing. She opened the door a crack, embarrassed to be doing so. Then farther. The bathroom was empty. She glanced around the small room as her throat closed with panic. The closet door was ajar. He couldn't be hiding in there. The bedclothes were rumpled. As she leaned over to check under the bed, because that's the only other place he could possibly be, someone outside screamed. Hazel straightened. The window was fully open. She hadn't noticed it when she first came in the room that it wasn't just cracked like before. It was wide open. Wide enough for someone to put one leg over, then the other. She rushed to it, horrified and certain she was wrong. Floyd had decided to go down to the bar. He'd taken the stairs, and that's why she couldn't find him. That's why he wasn't here. More screams. She made herself look down, where his crumpled form lay 10 stories below. He'd landed on his side, and lay there like he'd just fallen asleep, hands tucked under his cheek. The only sign of violence, the red blood pooling around him. Act 3.
The ghosts of the Chelsea Hotel draw closer, eager to greet their latest member the moment the soul leaves the flesh. Over the years, the dust of the hotel's many occupants has spread thinly over the walls, the floors, the mantels, and the hallways, though only a small number remain in spirit. The handrail on the stairs holds the residue of actors and poets, singers and dancers, passed from guest to guest. Great successes and bitter failures, or bitter successes and great failures. No matter. The dust lingers in the air, and when the woman breathes it in, her lungs fill with the heady hope of the innocent. Breathe again, and it's the desolation of the lost. Close now. But she keeps breathing.
Chapter 24. Hazel. March 1967. The cloying scent of marijuana wafted across the lobby of the Chelsea Hotel as Hazel returned from her morning walk. The obvious culprits, yet another group of long-haired musicians, judging from the mix of duffel bags and instrument cases scattered about. They looked like they'd been waiting for their rooms for a while and had dug in for the long haul. One man was fast asleep on a low banquette, another slung a jean-clad leg over the arm of a chunky Victorian chair and strummed a guitar. In the past several years, the hotel had attracted a different sort of artist than had come before. Beat poets and beaten ladies of the night, rumpled folk singers and vacant-looking pop artists. They scurried down the halls and stumbled down the stairway, making the place feel overwhelmed, congested, and unseemly. Even the walls of the lobby were chaotic, filled with a riot of paintings whose tight arrangement, less than an inch between the frames in some cases, rendered any serious appraisal of the works impossible. Hazel stepped over a guitar case and breezed forward, not wanting to appear like some fussy old lady, After all, she was only 47, who remembered with great nostalgia the days when the Chelsea Hotel was, if not elegant, at least respectable. The place had acquired a dirty mystique in the past 17 years. The communists on the first floor had been usurped by languid, underdressed prostitutes and their pimps, but none of this seemed to bother the permanent residents, who had gotten used to the parade of new bohemians who made the hotel their home for days or years at a time, the hippies, the groupies, the international artists and novelists who came and went. She just completed her daily, brisk walk up to Central Park and back down along 7th Avenue, although she always crossed to the west side at 51st Street, not wanting to pass the spot where Floyd's broken body had landed. Floyd's funeral had fallen on the same day that Charlie had asked Hazel to meet him at the library. Hazel decided it was a sign that she be done with all that, done with the fierce pain of fighting against a machine that was so much bigger than she was. Floyd's death had closed her down. She had nothing left. On her way to the service that morning, she'd dropped off a letter with the information clerk at the library and asked her to give it to Charlie when he appeared. She told her to look for a dark-haired man with a dimpled chin who would show up around noon. She'd written him that she'd moved on, found someone new, and it was best they not see each other again. It was the only way she knew that she could force him out of her life completely. "Hazel Stanley wants to see you," said the Chelsea's day clerk. When David Bard passed away 3 years earlier, his son Stanley took over his duties with the incompetent enthusiasm of a golden retriever. Not that David had been the most efficient hotel manager, but where the maids tended to blandly disregard David's directives, they openly mocked Stanley, who often laughed along with them, as if he were in on the joke. Hazel stepped back over the guitar case and turned into Stanley's office, where the Spanish leather padding on the walls reeked of cigarette smoke, and the clutter had reached epic proportions. Stanley rose as she entered, a lanky man wearing a stretched-out sweater badly in need of a trip to the dry cleaners.
"Hazel, how are you?"
He gestured for her to sit. She looked at her watch. "My shift starts in 5 minutes."
"That's fine. If you're a little late, it won't matter."
She'd been working the switchboard of the hotel for what felt like forever. It was a ghastly old piece of wiring beside the front desk, a throwback to another era that badly needed updating. The antiquated system often crossed lines, so Hazel would end up connecting a stoned actress on the second floor with the maudlin dress designer on the sixth, the two of them making no sense at all while refusing to hang up. There were days when Hazel was excoriated for not putting a call through fast enough, or was stuck chatting with Mr. Thompson because she was too polite to interrupt his musings. But David, and then Stanley, had let her work a couple of shifts each week in return for a free room, and for that she was thankful. The rest of her living expenses Hazel covered with a weekly beat reviewing theater for a downtown newspaper. Lavinia, once again coming to the rescue, had connected Hazel with the editor, who allowed her to write under the pen name W.S. Pear, and gushed over her reviews, which he said bristled with sharp observations. While reviewers for the New York Times and the Post still carried a lot of weight, the in crowd knew to look for Pear's column for the real skinny. The work kept Hazel connected to the theater world, which she still adored in spite of how it had mistreated her in the past.
"We need to make a couple of minor changes," said Stanley.
He rifled through the pile of yellowed papers on his desk before giving up on whatever he was looking for.
"There's a rock group here called something crazy like the Chipperskulls. These bands, I can't keep track of them anymore. Why are they so confusing?"
She shrugged, unsure of what this had to do with her. Better not to interrupt, as he'd make his way back to his point sooner or later.
"They want to rehearse, but say the rooms they're staying in are too small. I said to them, 'We're not a music studio,' but they won't listen, and told me they'll just practice right there in the lobby. Can you imagine?"
His voice rose an octave, a sure sign that he was irritated.
However, I think I've finally straightened it all out. You see, they need a large room to rehearse, and I thought we could do a little switcheroo.
How do you mean?
Well, your room is one of the original ones. It wasn't chopped up. And so for a little while, let's put you in 732.
You want me to change rooms?
Just for a little while.
She knew what that meant. He could get more money for her current room, a paying customer. Unfortunately, she had no lease to protect her, as his father had tended to not bother with leases after the first year, either unable or unwilling to deal with the paperwork. In any case, it wasn't as if she paid rent, so she really had nothing to stand on. She'd lived in the same room for so long, the idea of moving scared her more than she'd care to admit. Her parents had died within 6 months of each other a decade ago. This was her home.
But 732 is tiny, a cubbyhole. I won't be able to fit everything in there.
Right, we can put some things down in storage in the basement.
No way. Stanley often offered new tenants a crack at whatever was in the storage room when they first came on board, in order to get in their good graces. She imagined some wasted poet fingering her favorite lamp with the beaded shade, or the subdued watercolors she'd picked up at the flea market.
When do you need my room by?
Panic made her voice shaky. Stanley ducked his head.
Is it too much?
I'm so sorry. It's too much. My father would be so unhappy with me.
David Bard would also be unhappy at the way the more valuable paintings tended to disappear from the lobby walls every so often, most likely to enhance his son's private collection. Stanley might be goofy, but he wasn't dumb. In any event, Stanley wasn't going to change his mind, and she had nothing to negotiate with.
It's fine.
Great! How soon do you think you can pull the trigger? We'll have the staff help you out. You won't have to lift a thing.
I guess I can be out by the end of next week.
He looked up into space, as if calculating some complicated algorithm.
How about Monday?
That's 3 days away.
It's an easy move. You won't even notice the difference.
Room 732 could barely fit a twin bed. The one time she'd been inside, invited by a choreographer whose name she couldn't remember, Hazel had noticed that the curtains were stapled to the window frame. Stapled! But she couldn't leave the hotel. After all these years, it kept her connected to the heart of the city. Mr. Thompson still held his memorable cocktail parties, where a few times she'd spotted Arthur Miller and his third wife, a photographer, who lived in room 614. No one mentioned Hazel's play, probably out of politeness, and that was fine with her. She'd refilled drinks and acted as an ersatz maid, passing around the canapes and delighting in the lively conversation between artists, filmmakers, writers, and composers. She didn't mind being on the outside looking in, as long as they let her look, and as long as she still got to write. Luckily, Lavinia was still going strong, confined to a wheelchair, but making appearances at the Lavinia Smarts acting studio when the mood struck. And between the lively gang at the Chelsea and her nightly forays to the theater, Hazel's life was full, if not particularly joyous. And that was fine.
Very well, I'll start packing.
I'm sorry, Hazel. I promise it won't be forever, just until the band's finished up. They might even play a concert on the roof this summer. If they do, I'll make sure you get a ticket.
She couldn't imagine anything worse. Thank you, Stanley. After her shift, she popped into Lavinia's apartment, where her friend was dozing by the window, her gray hair almost translucent in the sunlight. She stirred as Hazel entered.
Hello?
It's me, Hazel. Sorry to wake you. I'll come back later.
No, no. Come, sit.
Lavinia had grown thinner with every passing year, her bracelets flopping around her tiny wrists, often falling off onto her lap. Her eyes, though, were as sharp as ever, her opinion strong and strident. God help the acting student who showed up unprepared for class, as Lavinia's thundering tirades were legendary in the theater community. After the news of Floyd's terrible death, as well as the injustices he'd suffered, spread throughout the theater district, The Broadway community banded together to mount a bulwark against the blacklist, with theater owners successfully employing actors who otherwise couldn't get hired. The ever-changing list of producers behind each production, as well as the fact that no one knew if a show would run for 3 performances or 3 years, made organized boycotts too difficult. And so, after that terrible year, the theater world began to flourish once again, unimpeded by the political machinations of Washington. Hazel, of course, was shunned from this support due to the scandal with Charlie, though even her pariah status had faded with time. At least Joseph McCarthy was no longer around to cause trouble. He'd tried to go after the U.S. Army in 1953 for communist subversion, but his bullying tactics finally fell flat and his popularity plummeted. When he died in 1957, Hazel was not sorry. "I have something for you," said Lavinia. She reached for an envelope on a side table, but her shaky hand couldn't grasp it. Hazel picked it up and took the chair opposite.
"What is it?"
"Open it up." Inside were 2 tickets to the Tony Awards, to be held at the Schubert Theater in 2 days' time. The note inside explained they were a gift from Jeffrey Hubert, a former student of Lavinia's who'd recently mounted a revival of wartime sonata to some acclaim at a claustrophobic downtown theater. While Hazel had granted the rights for the production, she'd avoided most of the rehearsals and sat through only 1 performance— her words too dear and painful to hear spoken out loud. The production had a small budget and a bare-bones set, and Hazel had kept her expectations low.
"How nice," she said. "That Jeffrey is a lovely boy. Too bad I'm not going."
"Yes, you are. I insist." Lavinia pounded her closed fist on 1 knee. "You deserve to get some kudos already, kiddo. Look at that article in the New York Times. You're on the rise."
In a way, Lavinia was right. To Hazel's surprise, the play had sold out and been extended 2. Soon after the glowing reviews appeared, Hazel and the director had been interviewed for a feature in the New York Times, where Hazel spoke with bitter honesty about her experiences during the McCarthy era. When the reporter inquired about her current relationship with the famous movie star Maxine Mead, Hazel had hedged, mumbling something about how actors were always falling out of touch, that it was the nature of the business. She examined the 2 tickets. "It's out of the question. There's no way I could sit in the audience and watch playwrights and actors accept awards, knowing that I'd been snubbed, cast out, knowing that if I'd begun my career in the late 1950s, after McCarthy was censured and the blacklist drifted into oblivion, I would have had a clear shot at a career as a playwright."
"Oh, stop with the self-righteous pity. You were caught in bed with the enemy, let's not forget."
Hazel began to protest, but Lavinia cut her off.
"I know, I know. True love and all that. In any event, what happened happened, the good and the bad. I would go myself if I wasn't stuck in this wheelchair. Before you know it, you'll be like me, an invalid, and wish you'd said yes more than you'd said no."
"You're far from an invalid."
Lavinia's voice dropped to a lower register, one that she used only when she was dead serious. "Please, Hazel, Jeffrey insists, and he'll be quite upset with me if you don't."
Up in her room, Hazel put the envelope with the tickets on the mantle of her fireplace. She couldn't decide anything right now. First, she had to deal with this ridiculous move. She started by blindly sorting through her clothes, tossing them into a suitcase. The dress she'd worn to the opening of Wartime Sonata on Broadway, the old winter coat she should have replaced a few years ago, the inside of the pockets reduced to shreds, but still couldn't afford to throw out. She stopped and poured a glass of wine to steady her nerves. Hazel spent too much time alone these days, which meant that she could get lost in her head if she weren't careful, the memories churning past like thunderclouds. A knock on the door interrupted her bleak thoughts.
"Who is it?"
These days, it wasn't smart to open your door without checking first. Drug dealers roamed the hallways, and every so often someone went out in a body bag, from either an overdose or a murder. But the peephole to Hazel's door had been painted over years ago. A muffled voice responded.
"Who?"
I can't hear you. The familiar voice, louder, echoed in her ears. Hazel, open up. It's me. It's Charlie. Charlie Butterfield. Hazel opened the door. Charlie stepped back as she did so, as if a gust of wind had blown him off balance. She put a hand to her hair, suddenly aware of how different she must look to him. In the past decade, she'd let it grow long, like the hippie girls who paraded through the halls in cut-off shorts and see-through tunics. Well, perhaps not quite as hippie as all that, but her formerly blonde locks were now streaked with gray, and her face, she knew, showed evidence of the hardship of her middle years. Like many men with boyish features, Charlie didn't seem to have aged much in the almost 2 decades they'd been apart. Just a few speckles of peppery gray along the temples and some lines at the corner of his eyes, but that was it. Charlie. He looked past her to the scattering of clothes and suitcases on the floor. You going somewhere? She stepped back, surveying the mess. You could say that. I was hoping we could talk. Can we talk? I don't want to intrude, but I have something important to tell you. She studied him, uncertain. After all this time, what did they really have to say to each other? She didn't want to bother explaining her decisions, nor did she want to hear his. Charlie must have sensed her reluctance. Look, I don't have to come inside. Is that diner down the street still around? Can we go there and I'll buy you a coffee or something? She could use a coffee. Her stomach growled. She was starving as well. Back when they were lovers, they'd order grilled cheese at the diner after their romps in bed. Back when? Fine. Give me a minute. She left him standing out in the hallway as she gathered her purse and coat, smoothing her hair in the mirror by the front door. This unexpected reunion hadn't sent her spiraling into confusion the way she might have expected it to. Then again, she'd dated men in the intervening years, even fallen in love a couple of times, although nothing lasted more than a year, usually because she got bored or annoyed. Life had moved on. The elevator descended slowly, stopping on the 4th floor to pick up a shaggy, deep-voiced kid. Stanley had mentioned he was some Canadian poet rock star, and a rough-looking woman he called Janice, who wore a blue fur coat that looked like it had been run over by a truck. They barely noticed Hazel and Charlie, murmuring gravelly whispers to each other as the car descended. Embarrassed, Hazel stared straight ahead. Out in the street, Charlie let out a breath. Wow, the hotel's really changed since I was there last. Her defenses kicked in. Only the residents had the right to disparage the place. Not really. It's still full of artistic types. It's just that the mediums have changed. Films are different. Songs are different. So the people who live in the Chelsea reflect that. Classical composers have been replaced by rockers. Compositional painters by pop artists. Who knows what it'll be like in another 20 years?
You sound like you don't mind it.
The entire city is different. You can't expect your little piece of the pie to stay the same. They made it to the diner, and she slid into a booth, happy to have the table between them. They both ordered coffee and grilled cheese. Charlie placed his napkin in his lap, not looking up.
My father was eventually sued. Did you hear about that?
She had. In 1962, a radio show host named John Henry Folk had won $3.5 million in a libel suit against Lawrence Butterfield and Vincent Hartnett for damage done to his name and career during the blacklist. In a strange twist, Charlie's father had died the night before the judgment was announced. I had heard. I'm sorry you lost your father. And she was. Having lost her own, she knew how disorienting it was to lose a parent, even one as pig-headed as Lawrence Butterfield. I'm glad Falk got his day in court and won, after everything my father did.
Right.
They ate in silence for a while. She waited him out, mainly because she had nothing to say. He finally cleared his throat.
That note you left for me at the library, you mentioned you'd met someone else. Who was he?
She couldn't lie anymore. What was the point? There was no other man. I didn't want to see you. Floyd Jenkins had just jumped to his death. I was there when it happened. I couldn't take it anymore. Her sentences came out short and sharp, like Morse code. I wanted to stop fighting, stop everything, live my life like a normal person, whatever that is. So I left that note, knowing it was the only thing that might stop you from reaching out. He sat back, looking like he'd been hit. It wasn't true? No. Oh. The look on his face reminded Hazel of a sped-up clock whirling away. You lied. I did. Why didn't you come back sooner, Charlie? Where were you for 5 months, not calling or writing, leaving me to fend for myself? He took a moment before answering, as if gathering courage. My father had me hospitalized upstate, supposedly for my epilepsy, but basically he wanted to keep me out of the way. I'd made too much trouble. You were involuntarily committed? Yes. They drugged me. I had no idea where I was or what day it was. As soon as I got out, I tried to contact you through Mr. Bard. I figured the FBI was still tapping the phones. Then, at the library, I got your note. For years, she'd assumed he'd deliberately stayed away, repulsed by her toxicity like so many others. Her heart broke for him, for both of them. I thought you were keeping your distance because you didn't want to be associated with me. I should have been clearer in my letter, but I was worried they'd find out somehow and come after me again. After I got your answer, I just took off. I traveled abroad for a time, before coming back and getting a job with the government, not as a federal agent. The hospitalization dashed any hope of that. But I worked my way up, and it's a decent job. A good one, to be honest. What exactly do you do? I work for an agency that tries to decipher Russian codes. After all this time. So, you're still obsessed with Russian spies? I am. He pushed aside his plate. To be honest, that's why I reached out. He hadn't come to declare his love then. Of course not. She chided herself for even considering the possibility. We recently uncovered some Soviet cables. It turns out a Soviet agent called Silver was the linchpin of all the activity that was going on back in 1950. Julius Rosenberg, David Greenglass, Harry Gold. Other than Rosenberg, who'd been executed along with his wife in 53, the names meant little to her. Charlie continued, I saw your interview in the New York Times, and I realized you might be able to shed light on some questions I have. I doubt that. I don't know anything about those people. He tapped a finger on the table. In that article, you mentioned that Maxine convinced you to cast her in the play when you were both in some tunnel under the Chelsea Hotel. The journalist had pushed Hazel for stories about her and Maxine during the original production, catching Hazel off guard. She wouldn't have brought it up otherwise, but he seemed to love the drama of it. She nodded. I wouldn't have thought twice about it, Charlie explained, except that it brought back strange memories of after we'd been ambushed. I remember being pushed through a long, dark passage. There were bare light bulbs and a dank smell. Was that the tunnel? Yes. That's how we got you to the ambulance, to avoid the press. Where is it exactly? It runs between a townhouse on 22nd Street and the hotel on 23rd. Before that, we'd used it to avoid the photographers lurking out front for Maxine. Charlie, unable to contain his excitement, knocked over his water glass. He waited until after the waiter cleared up the mess with a dish towel to continue. One of the cables discussed a near miss one night back in 1950 when the feds were on the trail of Silver, but then he disappeared on 22nd Street. I looked up the FBI's reports, and they say Silver went into a townhouse and vanished into thin air. They staked it out for days, but never saw him leave. You think he went into the tunnel and out through the hotel? That's what your article made me wonder. How did you get access to the townhouse? David Bard gave Maxine a key. Did he give any other residents a key? For God's sake, Charlie, I have no idea. She noticed him flinch and regretted her harsh tone. You think that maybe this Silver was connected to the hotel in some way? I wondered about it. In that case, he could be any of the commies who lived on the first floor in those days. The place was full of them. He wouldn't have been that obvious. Charlie looked around, as if he was worried someone was watching them. She almost laughed, as if anyone cared at this point. The world was full of tragedy, on the brink of disaster, if you read the newspaper headlines. Charlie's hunt for a communist spy was almost quaint. Poor guy was stuck in the past. His colleagues probably ridiculed him. Hazel considered herself lucky she'd been able to move forward with her life, even if it had been stunted, instead of living in the past the way he was. He lowered his voice. One of the ways the spies confirmed each other's identity when they first made contact was with a jello box top that was ripped in half. A vague memory of Charlie talking about jello box tops drifted back to her. She played along. Right, they each had a section, proof they were on the same team. You remember? He sat back, pleased. As I was reading that article, something else occurred to me. Do you remember the man Maxine dated, Arthur something?
Arthur, right. I don't recall his last name.
Arthur was in food packaging.
She couldn't help it. A bubble of laughter escaped, as were several hundred thousand other people at that time. Arthur was an ass and a manipulative son of a bitch, but he was just a boring corporate guy in the end. Nothing special about him.
Which would make him the perfect spy. She pushed her plate away.
You've got to be kidding. Now she was no longer hungry, and exhaustion overcame her. All she wanted was to go back to her room and sleep. How disappointing Charlie had turned out to be. It would have been better if he'd never come back, so she could retain her memories of their glorious affair without this melancholy overlay. Why would you care about a spy from years ago? He's probably dead by now, or gone back to Russia.
Because we've connected Silver's identity with that of an agent who's still going strong, according to recent cables. Different code name, but all our data points to it being the same guy. We know he's in his mid-50s now, which would make him around 37 or 8 back then. If we can identify him, we'd bring down an entire network. He paused, eyes steady on hers. I was wondering if you might remember the night in question, when they lost Silver's trail, in case you maybe saw the person but didn't know it.
I can't remember what happened last year, never mind in 1950.
It was July 3rd.
Ben's birthday. Every so often, Hazel wondered what it would have been like if her brother had lived. She would have had someone by her side during the crisis, the kind of guy who would have charmed Lawrence Butterfield within 5 minutes and in the next breath convinced him to invest in the production. Then again, if her brother had been alive, she doubted she would have achieved the heights that she did, writing and directing a show on Broadway. That drive had sprung from her need to live up to the family legacy, but had been replaced by ambition of her own, ambition that she never even knew existed. The taste of success had been delicious, but left her grasping for more, just as Ben's death had taken a chunk out of her heart. Charlie wasn't letting up.
Your play opened a few weeks later.
A sharp memory came back to her, clicking into place like one of those Viewmaster stereoscopes. She was dressing to go out. Maxine was upset. July 3rd was Maxine's birthday. She was weepy because Arthur hadn't reached out to her.
I see.
Charlie waited.
Nothing else?
We went to an opening of a show, some awful musical review. I took her to cheer her up.
Any sign of Arthur?
Later, after the show, we all went to a bistro and had coq au vin. Hazel gave herself a mental pat on the back for her acuity.
Really, you actually think Maxine was dating a spy?
As she said the words, a strange feeling ran through Hazel, like a shiver or a warning. She remembered all the intrigue surrounding Maxine's relationship with Arthur, the hold he had on her. The bruise. He'd been around that age, mid-30s, give or take a few years. No, Charlie was just getting her all worked up again. The idea was ridiculous.
Why don't you ask Maxine about him? She's the one who'd know if he seemed spy-like.
Still, after all these years, she couldn't talk about Maxine without a bolt of fury shooting through her.
"Have you seen or heard from her recently?"
asked Charlie.
"No, not at all. Not once."
"Right. I'd heard she gave names to Roy Cohn."
"She certainly did."
The waiter came by and dropped off the check. Charlie pulled out his wallet and left a few bills.
"She's in town. She's been asked to present an award at the Tonys on Sunday."
Hazel's mouth went dry. She wondered if Lavinia knew and hadn't told her.
"Is that so? She hasn't been on the stage since Wartime Sonata.
She's a movie star now. Everyone wants a piece of her. Trust me, I've been trying to reach her through her agent and her manager to ask her some questions, but can't get a response for the life of me."
Hazel stifled the urge to punch Charlie in the face, a movie star. The idea of Maxine being welcomed back by the theater folk she'd betrayed, all of them applauding while she glided on stage in some fancy gown, smiling and blowing kisses, of Charlie calling her a movie star, brought back everything Hazel had held so dear and lost. She'd suffered mightily, and no one cared. How dare Maxine even show her face? The grudge Hazel had carefully nursed since the blacklist turned malignant and dangerous. Charlie tucked his wallet into his pocket, oblivious. Hazel kept her voice even. "I have 2 tickets to the Tonys. I hadn't planned on going, but maybe you could speak to her there." Maxine wouldn't get away with it. Not this time. Chapter 25. Hazel. March 1967.
"What's with all the cameras?"
Hazel inched a little closer to Charlie as they wended their way down an aisle in the Schubert Theater, past dapper gentlemen in tuxedos and women dripping with jewels. "They're televising the awards for the first time." Charlie found their seats and led the way into the row.
"So all of America will be watching?"
"I suppose so."
"Just great. As if Maxine needs more exposure."
Hazel had been in a foul mood since Charlie had picked her up at the Chelsea. Going to the Tony Awards was a stupid idea on her part. First of all, she didn't have the right clothes. She'd put on a black satin gown that looked frumpy and out of date among the stylish actresses surrounding them. Hazel's hair was twisted back into a simple bun at the base of her neck, while all the other ladies had their hair teased up into fancy creations that, to Hazel, looked like wigs. What was the point? Just wear a wig. Second of all, she'd figured their seats would be way up in the top tier, where she could observe the scene from afar. To her shock, they were seated 3 rows from the stage, right on the aisle. She craned her neck around and looked up. Both balconies were packed, all the boxes full. So this was what it was like if you made it big. How nice for them all.
"Miss Ripley, I'm so glad you made it."
Jeffrey, the director of Wartime Sonata, swooped over, shaking her hand and introducing himself to Charlie, followed by several other producers doing the same. The bare-bones production of Wartime Sonata in a downtown factory building was all the rage, apparently. Too little too late, though. Hazel was polite but curt. No doubt some of these folks had been around back in the day and pushed aside the scripts she'd submitted, scared of facing blacklist backlash. Say that 3 times fast. She chuckled to herself, her nerves rising to the surface. "You all right?" Charlie asked. "This is bringing back some strange memories." "I had the same thought. At one time, we sat in a theater much like this one and ran the show."
"We?"
They both laughed. Those days when they parsed her play against the looming deadline of opening night were still a bright memory. Hazel hated to admit that she enjoyed sharing an armrest with him again.
"Do you have any new plays up your sleeve, Hazel?"
"Nothing came easy after Wartime Sonata."
"What about you? You consulting on theater productions in D.C.?"
He turned red. "I work with a small community theater, to be honest. Behind the scenes, not on stage," he added quickly. "We do 4 shows a year, and some of them, I must admit, are quite good."
"I think that's wonderful. Good for you."
"Seems neither of us can shake it, Mr. Pear." Hazel regarded him anew. Charlie was still full of surprises.
"How did you know about that?"
"I'd recognize your particular turn of phrase any day. Your reviews always make me smile." The idea that he knew Hazel well enough to recognize her writing gave her a small thrill. But before she could question him further, the curtain rose and the hosts for the evening, Mary Martin and Robert Preston, came out and welcomed the crowd. Hazel barely heard a word. Right now, Maxine was probably getting her makeup touched up in a dressing room, flirting with the stage manager to kill her nerves before presenting whatever award it was she'd be presenting. Ridiculous. After the first musical number, Joel Grey singing from Cabaret, they paused for a commercial break. Hazel rolled her eyes. "Next thing you know, all the Broadway shows will be televised, and writers will have to add in commercial breaks between scenes."
I doubt it will come to that. How do you propose we approach Maxine? What's your plan?
No plan. We'll find her at the party afterward at the plaza, and I'll pull her aside.
He cocked his head.
You're going to behave, aren't you?
Don't mess this up. If you were worried about that, you should have come alone. You're the one who invited me.
So, basically, you're using me?
No. His voice was firm. I wanted to see you. That article, the way it described how you'd been treated, it got me boiling with anger. I don't want people's pity. I would have preferred to be able to work back when I was inspired and young. You're far from old, and things seem to be going better for you now with the revival of the play.
I suppose so.
Keep in mind, the actors in this so-called revival had to compete with the rats for space in the dressing room. The ceremonies continued, with Cabaret and The Homecoming garnering most of the big awards.
And now we'd like to introduce the shining star, Maxine Mead, to hand out the award for Best Actress in a Play.
Robert Preston motioned to the wings as Maxine swished out in a dress of silver lamé. Maxine walked with confidence, her shoulders back. Her hair was longer, wavier than Hazel remembered. In the past almost 2 decades, Maxine had carved out a respectable career. Her film with James Mason had been a hit, and since then her face had graced all the magazine covers. Life, Time, Harper's Bazaar. Hazel wished she was sitting farther back. What if Maxine spotted her? While everyone else clapped, Hazel crossed her arms in front of her chest. Charlie gave her a sideways glance, checking in. Up on stage, the reflected light from Maxine's dress gave her a shimmering aura. Fake lashes had been plastered on her eyelids, while her lips glistened with a pinker hue than she used to wear. Maxine had kept up with the changing fashions. Yet while age hadn't been exactly kind to Hazel, Maxine hadn't been spared either. Her formerly sculpted cheeks were transitioning into jowls, and thin, horizontal wrinkles crisscrossed her neck. Her voice, though, with its familiar, raspy tone, brought out of their interment all the memories Hazel had buried. That voice, booming in El Quijote, whispering a snarky comment backstage, speaking German in the radio room in Naples. The voice of a woman she had once adored. Maxine listed the nominees for leading actress in a play and called out the winner, Beryl Reed, for her performance in a show called The Killing of Sister George. Hazel had seen it and enjoyed it thoroughly. Nice to know that a play with an all-women cast could hit it big these days. At the end of Reed's speech, there was a moment of confusion as Maxine began to lead her off stage, but was stopped by Robert Preston. Reed disappeared behind the curtain, while Preston guided Maxine back into the spotlight. A look of bewilderment flashed over Maxine's face, but she kept a steady smile in spite of whatever glitch had occurred.
"And now, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to give a special award."
Robert Preston pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket. Dear God, were they going to give Maxine a Tony for gracing their stage with her presence? If so, Hazel would storm off, never mind protocol. She tensed, at the ready. Maxine looked out into the audience with a raised eyebrow, as confused as the rest of them. He read out loud,
"After so many years, today is a day of reckoning. The theater community was, for the most part, unaffected by the terrible events of the Blacklist when the McCarthy era threatened the very creativity and freedom that America stands for."
The Blacklist? If they gave Maxine some kind of award and mentioned the Blacklist in the same breath, Hazel wouldn't storm off. She'd run screaming onto the stage, snatch the award away, and bludgeon Maxine with it.
"What the?" murmured Charlie. Preston continued,
"Yet while the film, television, and radio industries are best known for coming under direct fire, several of our theater community's members were also affected. Tonight, we acknowledge them. We acknowledge brilliant artists like Lavinia Smartz, Lillian Hellman, Uta Hagen, Zero Mostel, and Floyd Jenkins. We acknowledge that they suffered, that they were denied unalienable rights. We acknowledge that a terrible miscarriage of justice took place, and that too few spoke out at the time. Alas, some who've been harmed cannot be with us tonight, but we are lucky to have one virtuoso present who stood up to the madness."
Maxine looked as if she were going to crack wide open. Her smile turned to fear. Hazel's heart pounded, and she gripped Charlie's hand as if that might stop what was coming. Preston chuckled merrily.
I actually have two special announcements to make. First of all, breaking news, folks. I was informed earlier this evening that the acclaimed revival of Wartime Sonata will return to the Great White Way next season.
Hazel had known the producers were trying to raise the money for a Broadway transfer, but had written it off to the misguided enthusiasm of neophytes. Very rarely would a play make such a leap, hardly ever. Yet they'd pulled it off. The audience erupted in applause. Her mind reeled, trying to process the unexpected good news. This was why Lavinia had insisted Hazel take the tickets. Preston gestured to Maxine.
Even better, we're lucky enough to have the star of the original cast here to present a special award. Once again, Maxine Mead.
He handed the paper he'd been reading from to Maxine, who took it with shaking hands. She scanned it and then looked out into the audience with a half-smile.
Actors hate it when the playwright changes the script right before a performance. Or during.
The audience laughed as the mood in the room shifted. Curious to know what was next. Maxine took a deep breath.
For valor and strength in terrible circumstances, the American Theater Wing would like to award a special Tony Award to the playwright and my friend.
Her voice cracked on the last word. This was spiraling out of control. Not at all what Hazel wanted. It was all a terrible mistake, a terrible mess. Maxine looked out into the audience like a prisoner of war.
Miss Hazel Ripley.
Hazel turned to Charlie, confused. What is going on? She mouthed. Around them, people clapped and cheered.
You've got to go up and say something, Charlie finally said.
She shook her head. I don't know what to say. She couldn't hear his reply. The noise of the crowd was too much. He helped her rise to her feet. Once out of her seat, she located the stairs with what felt like tunnel vision, focusing only on what was directly in front of her. If she looked up, she feared she might trip or freeze. She didn't want to go up on that stage, up to Maxine. Everything about this was wrong. Trumpets blared a generic melody as she climbed the steps while holding her skirt in one hand, her mind racing. How could they have put her on the spot like this? They thought this was some kind of honor? That shaggy-haired director, she was certain, was behind all this. A way to get his show an injection of publicity. And a way for all of these people, the ones clapping until their hands hurt, to feel better about themselves for staying quiet when they should have stood up for justice when it mattered. Or others who'd turned in their colleagues and stolen careers out from under them. She wondered if Lavinia had been in on this. Over the years, Lavinia had inquired about the rift between Hazel and Maxine, gently encouraging Hazel to reach out and forgive her friend. But Hazel had shut down any further discussion, and eventually Lavinia had stopped bringing it up. The stage. She'd made it. Maxine stood to the side of the thin microphone, clapping her hands. Another woman handed a small plaque to Maxine, who, in turn, handed it to Hazel, their fingers not touching. The solidity and weight of the plaque helped ground Hazel. The applause didn't die down.